Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is Allie Wayne, Abolitionist Immigration Activist. Allie Wayne, spelled A-L-Y-W-A-N-E, is an undocumented immigrant who has been organizing around immigration issues for over 20 years. An abolitionist immigration activist is someone who believes the current U.S. immigration enforcement system, ICE, Border Patrol, detention centers, deportation courts, and the laws that empower them, is fundamentally harmful and should be dismantled rather than reformed. The term abolitionist signals a radical reimagining of how societies handle migration, moving away from punishment, surveillance, and exclusion, and toward care, mobility, and belonging. Allie Wayne spoke on February 9, 2026 at a webinar sponsored by the Syracuse, New York Peace Council. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
So I'll just start by introducing myself. My name is Allie Wayne. I have been here in Syracuse now for over 20 years. My sort of home organization is the Syracuse Peace Council. In the context of this conversation, probably one of the more important things that you need to know about me is that I'm not just an immigrant originally from Senegal, but I'm an undocumented immigrant. I have been an undocumented immigrant ever since 96 when I lost my student visa about, quite a few years back. But I have been specifically organizing on immigration. And also I did some work with Black Lives Matter Syracuse since maybe the mid-2000s or so. And, one of the things that I could say to sort of like as part of the introduction is that, first off, as someone who has organized on immigration issues, I would say that nothing that I've seen this past year coming from the Democrats has surprised me. Absolutely nothing. These are the same people we have been, as immigrant organizers, that we have been struggling with for years. And one of the things I often tell people is that every positive thing that we've gotten on immigration has almost been despite the Democrats, especially Democratic Party leadership, rather than because of it. A lot of the immigrant organizing that we have done has been really this uphill battle of trying to convince Democrats that our lives matter, because the issue has been that for the past many years, every single time they have struggled with the issue and they look at the polls, they immediately get scared and think that they're going to be painted as too friendly to immigrants, and then they cave on enforcement and we get almost nothing in terms of relief, which has been extremely frustrating. I came to this country legally, brought here by my single mother when I was, 8 years old, all the way back in 1985, back when there was that radical lefty Reagan who actually passed immigration amnesty back then. You know, that gives you a sense of how far we've moved. So I lost my status in 96, but I restarted my sort of green card process around 2012, when I decided, along with a lot of undocumented immigrant organizers at the time, to come out and share my status publicly. You know, I'm sure some of you have heard about sort of the undocumented youth movement, you know, people coming out as undocumented and unafraid. By the time I came out, I was definitely not a youth. Like, within the movement, I am definitely one of the older folks. But the piece that I wanted to share is that in 2012, my sister, who became a U.S. citizen through a different immigration pathway, started my green card process. So 2012, right, is when she started the process. In 2020, I finally heard from USCIS telling me that I had cleared the first hurdle to the green card process. Under the current system, if nothing changes, if it doesn't get worse, I still have to wait until 2029 to even affirmatively apply for the actual green card. And the thing that is important for people here to understand is that I'm one of the lucky ones because I was brought here legally. And because I was brought here legally, I have a path, you know, even though it's this super long path that feels eternal, it's at least a path. One of the things that people don't talk about enough is that the great majority of people who are undocumented have no path to citizenship whatsoever. So when you hear the whole kind of right-wing framing of like, oh, because you're hearing this in all of the horror stories, right? Like you see an article about someone who just got deported who's been here for like 20, 25, 30 years. And you always see someone commenting like, well, this person's been here for all this time. Why haven't they applied? What they don't understand is that very often there is no path for that person to legalize, or that path is extremely long. And to bring this conversation back to the structural legislative process, by my reckoning, the last time that we had a shot at actual immigration reform, which would create a path to citizenship for undocumented people like myself, I'm thinking it was about 2013. That version of immigration reform was so terrible that as an organizer, I struggled to actually tell people that I organized with to support it. The proposal would give undocumented immigrants a 12 to 15 year path to citizenship. And of course, they'd have to get in the back of the line, pay back taxes, learn English. I mean, there were all sorts of things. There were even provisions within that immigration proposal that had minimal income requirements. So if that passed, in order to remain legal, you couldn't earn an income below a certain level. Otherwise, you would lose your status and could end up being deportable. So that awful piece of legislation in 2013 was demonized as amnesty by Republicans back then. I remember Republicans calling it amnesty and saying it was too lenient. And I remember at that moment thinking to myself, well, we're never going to get like a path to citizenship that makes sense, because if something as right-wing, as conservative as that plan is considered too lenient, these folks are never going to come to the table. And this is actually an insight that I do want to share with you about sort of the broader immigrants' rights movement. And here, I don't want to speak to the immigrants' rights movement as a broader representative, because there's so many different parts of it. There's the undocumented youth movement that works with Dreamers. There are people who work on the border. There's this farm worker organizing. But what I can say is that the broader movement as a whole came to understand that the path to reform would be extremely hard. And not just hard, but that the odds are that the Democrats would not have the stomach to fight for our rights. And unfortunately, we were basically correct. But what I will say in terms of us organizing with the Democratic Party, I can't even say that we organize with the Democratic Party. One of my best insights in terms of organizing over the years on this issue has been that there's the self-interest of the Republican Party, there's the self-interest of the Democratic Party, and then there's the self-interest of undocumented people. And the thing that was the most useful for me to understand is that even though Democrats often talk as if they have the self-interest of undocumented immigrants in mind, in practice, what has happened is that whenever the self-interest of Democrats has clashed with the self-interest of undocumented people, we have been thrown under the bus every single time. At the federal level, the best piece of legislation that we were able to achieve, and I remember at the time thinking that it was really conservative and nowhere near close to what we needed, but it was a big push, was the passage of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which, I mean, it's not nothing, right? It allowed people who were undocumented, young people of a certain age, because there were definitely brackets, you know, you couldn't be older than a certain age, you can be younger than a certain age. There was a specifically segmented population that could apply basically for work permits, because that's all DACA is basically creating another layer of indentured laborers. That's all it was, you know, like a lot of conservatives talk about DACA like it was this big amnesty. The biggest problem with DACA is that all it was basically you're allowed to not be deported as long as you're willing to pay a fee that gives you the right to work for 2 to 3 years at a time. That's all DACA was. And even as many of us organized towards DACA, and I remember I was kind of reluctant to organize towards DACA, but at the time there was literally no relief whatsoever. And we had pushed on immigration reform. Republicans were awful. Democrats were awful. There was nothing we could get. So we pushed for DACA. And I would say that by my reckoning, it took about 2 years of the concerted effort of undocumented immigrants to convince the Democratic Party that DACA was worth it. And I'm talking everything. I'm talking sit-ins, like blocking streets. There were people in groups who were infiltrating detention centers, undocumented folks infiltrating detention centers. I mean, all sorts of radical actions. In fact, I remember the day that Barack Obama announced that he would go for DACA. Literally that day, I had friends who were engaging in nonviolent sit-ins in Obama campaign offices. It had been the culmination of 2 years, 2 years of pressuring that party to simply get us that little thing. And of course, the problem with DACA is that DACA did not come with any path to citizenship whatsoever. All it said was, we're not going to come for you and your family if you're willing to pay a fee, which is already cruel if you think about it. You basically had to pay for your freedom from fear temporarily. That's all that was. But the fights that we had with the Democrats on this, in fact, when Obama finally pushed for DACA and passed it, Republicans used his own former rhetoric against him because they were like, well, actually, you know, how dare you go for DACA? Because here you are saying that you don't have the power or you shouldn't be able to do so. So that just gives you a sense of how hard it was to fight for even that extremely conservative piece of legislation. My sense is that after Democrats won DACA, really thanks to the incredible labor and pressure of a lot of activists, some immigrants, some non-immigrant U.S. citizen allies, I got to be honest, I feel like what happened is that they kind of were resting on their laurels. They were like, "This is we've done enough for you people in terms of the attitude of the Democratic Party." And so we got to this place where, you know, it was maybe 2014, 2015, right before Trump got in office, he was starting to really hammer like the kind of fascist xenophobia that we're seeing now. And the problem is that the Democrats being always, always as per usual, being afraid of being seen as too friendly to immigrants or too soft on immigrants, said almost nothing in response to this. So what you had was basically 10 years, longer than that, of like this kind of narrative imbalance, right? On the Republican side, you had like just the nastiest, the most xenophobic stuff about how immigrants are rapists and criminals and blah, 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 with Democrats largely leaving that narrative space to them. There was no counter narrative. And I'm mentioning that because right before Trump was in office, if you asked people, if you polled people about the mass deportations as an agenda item, that was a minority opinion. Something like 20% of folks were like in favor of the types of mass deportations that got popularized by Trump. By the time Trump got to his second inauguration, a slight majority of the American people were in favor of that mass deportations project. And I'm 100% clear that the reason that happened is because the Democrats did nothing to counter the incredibly xenophobic narrative that was coming from Republicans. And actually, I remember that it got so bad that all of a sudden I started to realize that as a layer, even Democratic Party voters were starting to parrot some of the right-wing talking points that were powering MAGA. And I remember thinking to myself, I can't even blame them because look at the narrative environment that we're in. Like, who's talking about immigration right now? It's Republicans. It's not the Dems. And bringing us sort of to this era, this moment now, I have a lot of friends who are immigrant organizers, some undocumented, some aren't, some just became citizens, all that. No one is surprised by what we've seen in 2025 from the Democrats on immigration, or rather what we have not seen from the Democrats on immigration. There's a piece of me that's like, well, of course I knew this was coming. Although there are still moments where I'm just like, really, like even now that we're in the midst of these like immigrant hunting pogroms, because that's where we're at right now, the Dems have been extremely weak, because by the time we got to the Biden immigration proposal, which is basically the immigration proposal that Harris ran with in 2024, that was a deeply right-wing immigration reform proposal. Deeply right-wing. I can't even remember if it had any path to citizenship in it. Like, most of the provisions in the immigration reform proposal that was proposed by the Democrats was conservative and right-wing, to the point that before the election, I was talking to a bunch of my immigrant organizer friends, and the way people were preparing, we were basically saying to ourselves, well, whoever wins, we're kind of screwed. That's the way we were looking at it, that it was either we were going to get the extreme version of xenophobia, which is what we're living in right now, the dystopia, or we were going to get a right-wing version of an immigration proposal from the Democrats. And all of us understood that regardless of which party was in office, we needed to prepare to do immigrant defense against deportations, and we needed to prepare for an increase in immigrant detention. I'm not one of those persons who just kind of like, there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats, it's the same thing. That's not true. I don't want to take it to the point where you think like it's this nihilistic thing, like no one cares about immigrants, there's no point. There's definitely a difference between the type of just full-on racist, white supremacist xenophobia that we're dealing with and the kind of like neoliberal nightmare we would have gotten out of someone like, you know, Harris or whoever, whichever Democrat got in office. But either way, it's just to sort of plant you in the idea that like, all of this weakness that we're seeing from the Democrats is what we immigrant organizers have been dealing with the entire time. I have not been surprised at any point of this, because this is who they have been. In fact, if you want to really ground the beginning of the modern day incarceration and deportation machine in the U.S., you have to go back to Bill Clinton, to the bills that he passed in 1996 that deeply increased the criminalization of immigrants. And then, of course, 9/11 happened, and then that really created the apparatus of DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and then the immigration conversation became wedded with the national security conversation, and all of a sudden, every immigrant was basically a potential terrorist. So this is kind of what we've been dealing with.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Allie Wayne, Abolitionist Immigration Activist. An abolitionist immigration activist is someone who believes the current U.S. immigration enforcement system, ICE, Border Patrol, detention centers, deportation courts, and the laws that empower them, is fundamentally harmful and should be dismantled rather than reformed.
The problem is that the Democrats are still framing this as if we are talking about immigration, as if we are talking about legality. We are so far beyond immigration and legality. What we're seeing under MAGA is an openly white supremacist assault on the United States of America. We just got through with the Super Bowl, right? And what was the MAGA complaint? That Bad Bunny was a foreigner. He's from Puerto Rico. Like, we all know this, right? He's from Puerto Rico. He's a U.S. citizen. We know what this conversation about immigration is. In fact, one of Trump's loony bins, her name is Laura Loomer, she's one of his advisors, she was watching the Super Bowl yesterday, and she posted a couple of awful racist things. And one of them was that she basically said that ICE should be basically rounding up the people at the Super Bowl. It's not about citizenship. And the thing about that, and that I really want you all to understand, is that this has always been the case. Like, this kind of white supremacist explosion that we're seeing with MAGA has always been at the heart of the immigration conversation. When I really first started to get deep into sort of the ideological roots of the anti-immigrant movement in the U.S., this was quite a few years ago, I realized that so many of the so-called anti-immigrant think tanks that are used regularly by the Republican Party come from a family of think tanks that come from a network called the John Tanton Network. John Tenton was basically this literally like a white nativist and eugenicist, an extremely wealthy person who founded all of these think tanks to basically demonize immigrants. And it's hard to convey to you how respected these think tanks are and how they are used today. I'm talking about the Center for Immigration Studies. I'm talking about FAIR. These are all groups that are very mainstream and that sometimes even Democrats used. And they come from basically a directly white nativist network. One of the things that really shocked me when I started to do this research was just how much I had to wade into just the muck of white nativism. And all of it was there. Just, you know, the anti-black racism, you know, anyone who's a person of color is a mongrel. There were tons of like open anti-Semitism, which is obviously a complicated conversation now with like Israel and how that's been weaponized. But it was there the whole time. I mean, I was reading about this stuff in the late 2000s. In fact, my primary argument in 2016 for why the left, you know, once Bernie Sanders went down and we basically only had Clinton versus Trump, my principal argument with other organizers at the time was just like, listen, I don't like Hillary Clinton. She's just not someone that I would want to vote for. However, I don't know exactly what Trump's policies are going to be, but I know who Stephen Miller is. I have been reading about Stephen Miller for quite a few years. The man is a lunatic and he is just the purest of pure white supremacists, which is of course kind of ironic because he's of Jewish origin, but like, you know, that's another complicated conversation. But the point is, by then, I knew enough about Stephen Miller, who, by the way, had already appeared on, he was already on the radar of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is, you know, one of the most mainstream anti-racist organizations in the country. They had him on their list of the most dangerous white nativists in the country in the early 2010s. So it was horrendous watching this little Nazi, basically all the way back then, just stroll into the White House. So all of the stuff that we've been seeing with like this open white supremacy, it's not like MAGA stoked it. It was always there at the heart of the anti-immigration movement. In fact, as a black immigrant, one of the things that I was confronted with and that a lot of us who were undocumented and black immigrants had to deal with was the fact that like when we're having a conversation about citizenship, you're inherently having a conversation about race. Because when people say citizen, they mean white. You know, this goes back to what I was just saying about the Super Bowl, that has always been a part of the conversation. That's why, you know, now that I'm talking about the Super Bowl again, I actually kind of ventured and checked out that awful Turning Points USA halftime show with Kid Rock. And it was just basically a bunch of white people playing country music, right? And like that visual didn't surprise me because I'm just like, yeah, that's the target audience along with white evangelicals. And MAGA now, I would say that in the past 4 months or so, I would assert that MAGA has fully dropped the mask, that now they have fully embraced white supremacy. If you look at some of the social media posts coming out of the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Labor for some reason, which is weird, they are literally cribbing stuff from white supremacist sites. The messaging is about as clear as it possibly can get. Trump himself has started talking about how the civil rights obviously, you know, harmed white men. They are fully in their white supremacist bag. And if you think about where we are right now, right, and these incredibly brutal assaults into these different cities, like the recent ones that we've been seeing, Minneapolis, what was the excuse? Somali, once again, Somali black immigrants stoking very deliberately that anti-black racism in the base to get them to support a MAGA agenda that to support ICE. And ICE is, of course, really more of a paramilitary force than it is an immigration force. And they've already started talking about going into Springfield, Ohio. Why? Bunch of Haitian immigrants are there. and the Trump administration is trying to take away temporary protective status, basically legal status, from legal immigrants, legal Haitian immigrants who have been here for years, you know, 10, 15, however many years. He is deliberately trying to take away their status so that he can incarcerate and deport them. But the biggest thing is that he needs the PR. And what I mean by the PR is that he needs these black bodies to convince MAGA, let's keep going. I'm saying this because when you talk to your Democratic Party representatives, congressmen, all of that, and they're just kind of like, well, you know, we should really think about the legal issues. And, you know, we get a couple of body cameras here and there, like that might do the trick. We are so beyond body cameras. They murdered in cold blood two white U.S. citizens, white U.S. citizens in cold blood on video. And I remember actually when Renee Good was murdered, God bless her soul, when she was murdered, within 30 minutes, I posted on my social media, you watch, what they're going to do is they're going to indict her. They're never going to admit that they did anything wrong, and they are going to go after her. The reason that I knew that and that many immigrant organizers knew that is that this is what they have been doing for years. ICE and CBP are vicious, and we are seeing the worst of their viciousness. But it's just a slight escalation from the crap that they've been doing to immigrants for years with, you know, nary a peep from the broader sort of population, largely because the Democrats have been kind of looking the other way. And because ICE and CBP are law enforcement, they have all of these legal protections that allow them to, number one, lie to immigrants. And that also, whenever there's, if there is ever any prosecution of any of these agents, the legal system is heavily weighted towards letting these folks go. So even before Trump, this was an agency that was completely lawless and that was drunk on its own power. In fact, this is a problem that Barack Obama himself faced. On immigration, Obama was awful. He did earn the nickname the Porter-in-Chief because he broke all sorts of deportation records. But it wasn't because of personal animosity. He was like a lot of Democrats. He thought to himself, once I become president, I'm going to push for a ton of enforcement. And once I've compromised on enforcement, surely Republicans are going to come to the table and want to compromise on immigration reform. And he demonstrated what basically the whole cycle and the process of what's happened over the past many years, which is that Democrats are always okay to compromise on enforcement. And Republicans, whenever they get that compromise, they're like, oh, wait, you give us more money for like a wall or for, you know, for border security? Great. Now we want X. Now we want Y. Now we want C. So they kept moving the goalposts further and further and further to the right. And every step of the way, the Democrats were caving in, thinking to themselves naively, maybe the Republicans will come on board. In fact, that was the big epiphany that Barack Obama had around DACA. He only pushed for DACA once he finally realized that despite the number of people that, you know, incarcerated, deported, and all of that, that the Republicans were never going to come to the table. And that's when he realized, just in terms of legacy, that he didn't simply want to be known as someone who was like this awful, you know, anti-immigrant president. That was the last kind of barrier that helped him go over the whatever reservations he had about DACA. But this is what we've been dealing with for a long time, and this is the thing that I want to engage you in a conversation about, which is the kind of framing that you need to bring to the Democrats. Like, first of all, you need to assume that they're not going to be necessarily on our side. And you have to push them on the framing because they are not going to come to it by themselves. At some point, I wrote down what I call the cycle with Democrats in terms of immigrant organizing the past couple of years, is that a bunch of us immigrant activists would come up with some radical action that we believed would move our community in a positive direction and might pressure legislation in a good direction. We would decide on some sit-in, you know, or something like that. We would come to Democratic Party leadership. Leadership would tell us, absolutely not, don't do it. It's going to look bad. You're going to lose, you know, people. We would basically say, you know what, F it. we're just going to do it because at the end of the day, it's our lives and we have to do it. We would do the action. Most of the time, it would end up being effective and it would move politically things in the right direction. And then Democratic Party representatives would show up in our spaces and take credit for the action that we did. And then the cycle would repeat. The next time it would come up to them with like some new action, just saying like, we need to do this. They would tell us, no, don't do it. We do it. It's effective. They come, they co-opt the work. So that's just to give you like the sense of how hard it has been to move these folks and how it's really important to push them. And in this particular moment, to hammer to them that what we're dealing with is an uprising of white supremacy, of open white supremacy. I'll give you another example of that recently when Trump basically imported some of these South African immigrants from the country. Some people were confused. I was not. I knew exactly what that was coming from because as early as 2014, I started noticing that on the internet there was this movement, quote unquote, called the white genocide movement. And the idea was that in different countries and communities, not just the United States, the population of people of color was about to surpass the population of white people. And they termed that regular demographic process, they termed that white genocide. And one of the countries that was the most gripped with that conspiracy was South Africa. And in South Africa, there was just all sorts of conspiracy theories about how blacks were running rampant, just murdering white people left and right. And so when Trump imported these Afrikaners, I was just like, that's it. That's the connection. It's the white genocide thing. And I actually thought to myself, you know what? They're going to keep it on the down low because it's kind of like, I mean, that connection with a white supremacist movement. But no, like Trump actually was out there saying, like, yeah, we need to protect these people because of the genocide happening in South Africa, which of course confused the president of South Africa, who was just like, what are you talking about? But all that to say is that these white nativist movements have been organizing for a long time, and Trump is quite intentionally and directly using those movements. And those movements endanger anyone who basically isn't a white male, because there's a ton of sexism and homophobia and patriarchy that also comes with this type of fascism. All that to say is that when we talk to our Democratic Party representative, we need to really push back on this idea that this is about like legality. This is about rising white supremacy. And if we don't frame it in that way and we allow these white supremacists to kind of like lull us into this idea that it's about immigration, given who the Democrats are, they are going to compromise our way into full fascism. Now, the good news is that I would say that right now we have the people, we have the numbers. Unfortunately, they have the institutional power. The people are already there. Like the Democratic Party base is already there. This is one of the things that has been driving me insane. And obviously, because I'm undocumented this past year, I've had to really retrench a lot of my frontline organizing, like a lot of other immigrant organizers. And we're all talking to each other like, what is wrong with this party? Because I have never seen a Democratic Party base that is so hyped up. And if you look at the defense of immigrants that we've been seeing in these assaults, Chicago, LA, Minneapolis, like it has been admirable. There are so many times when, I'm in the midst of like, oh, the Democrats and we're not doing anything, blah, blah, blah. And then I read a story about like a badass teacher in some like rural area who is protecting her kids at school. And I'm like, okay, we're gonna be okay. Like the people are there and it's showing up in the polls. As much as MAGA has tanked in the polls, the Dems are basically right there with them. The Democratic Party brand is in the toilet as we speak. And every time they cave on these shutdowns or they move in a more compromising situation, they start to lose in the polls. So that's the question where sometimes I even get into conspiracy theories about it. Because genuinely, for the longest time, as a leftist, my consolation has been, Well, you know, like I'm pretty far to the left, and maybe the Democratic Party is kind of looking at the polls and, you know, they're obeying what their voters want. But now, if you look on issue after issue, their own voters are considerably to the left of what the Dems want. If anything, the Democratic Party leadership is trying to cram down the throat of regular voters ideas that are deeply unpopular. Like, I don't know if you guys remember the whole conversation about the abundance agenda, which was this kind of reframing of neoliberalism that focused on regulation and deregulation. And Ezra Klein was the big guru of that. He's a big pundit with the Democrats. And I remember reading through what that policy agenda was like, and I was just like, that kind of sounds like a Republican policy agenda. Sure enough, they did some polling about the abundance agenda. Democrats didn't like it. Independents didn't like it. You know who liked it? Conservative voters. Conservative voters were just like, hey, this abundance thing is great. So that's how far Democratic Party leadership is. They're so lost in this kind of technocratic, like neoliberal, we need to appeal to the capitalists and to the billionaires that they've totally lost. But the other side of that is, they don't have the people. We have the people. Now is the perfect time to radicalize the sort of indivisible move-on crowd. I've had so many positive conversations with just regular Democratic Party voters who, I mean, they're on board. If you talk about this whole like No Kings protest, for example, it's full of people who for years were basically like, yeah, the Dems have our back. And in the past year, they're just like, no, we need to get rid of like Schumer and Jeffries. But a major obstacle is Democratic Party leadership. And as far as I can tell, they refuse to budge right now. Beyond the conspiracy theories, the best I can understand what's going on with Democratic Party leadership is that they have gotten so used to basically taking direction from the donor class, which for the longest time has been basically the tech billionaires, that they can't think outside of that imaginary box. And that is one of the major issues. And as you've all seen in 2025, the tech billionaires who used to be the folks who supported Dems, as soon as they saw the writing on the wall about MAGA, they abandoned the party. And there's actually been a lot more energy from Democratic Party leadership trying to regain these folks rather than focus on that. But I do think that there has to be a limit. And this goes back to what we were talking about in terms of like, I do think that we actually, ideologically, we already have the people.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Allie Wayne, Abolitionist Immigration Activist. An abolitionist immigration activist is someone who believes the current U.S. immigration enforcement system, ICE, Border Patrol, detention centers, deportation courts, and the laws that empower them, is fundamentally harmful and should be dismantled rather than reformed.
It is still, to a certain degree, a democracy. And I don't think that they can withstand the pressure of like organized groups like, you know, Indivisible, Move On, and of course, the sort of the broader leftist coalition, especially when they have poll numbers that are so atrocious. That being said, I don't know about practical steps because every single time I've thought to myself, like, okay, now they're going to have to start to cave. They've kind of doubled down and anchored themselves. And maybe some of it is just like not getting gaslit by them about sort of the way forward. But we have some structural issues. And we can see the difficulty of this in the Mamdani conversation. And by the way, there's a lot to say about where he is now as an elected as opposed to where he was as a campaigner. But if I were someone who actually cared to grow the Democratic Party, I would be so excited about someone like Mamdani who was pulling from every single one of the demographics that like Democrats say that they were struggling with, including men. And by the way, and this is another thing that I always keep in my mind about just like the lameness of Democratic Party response after the Harris lost. One of their major projects that they spent a tremendous amount of money on after the Harris loss was they spent millions of dollars on a study of men and what their opinions were, as if the real issue was that in this entire system, really, men haven't been listened to enough. Like, It's insane. And of course, whenever there's an actual leftist candidate like Mamdani who pulls from those same men, they look the other way. The thing that is exciting about this, though, it's not just the Democratic Party base. It's also a slight layer of the conservative MAGA base as well. One of the things that I paid attention to was that in 2016, if you asked union representatives like who their rank and file were supporting, it was basically Trump or Bernie Sanders. And in 2024, there was a very similar phenomenon of that some of the same people who voted for Trump also were huge supporters of AOC, you know, which she herself was smart enough to figure out. And she had these great conversations about it. So all that to say is that there's absolutely room in that economic sort of populist space to increase the margins. But that's where we get into the structural issue of Democratic Party leadership being so embedded in that sort of corporate structure that I don't even know if they can imagine a world outside of it, which is why they've painted someone like Bernie Sanders, who, by my understanding, is less radical than FDR was. But within the Democratic Party of today, he's seen as way too far to the left. That's because the Democratic Party itself has gone too far to the right. We're not going to be able to compromise our way around this. There's not going to be some kind of middle ground policy that is going to appease MAGA. MAGA is a movement that right now is gobbling up the very heart of U.S. democracy as a whole. We've gone way beyond immigration. In fact, at the beginning of 2025, I remember thinking to myself, like, I don't know if this country is safe for, like, immigrants. Beginning of 2026, I'm like, I don't know if this country is safe. And full disclosure, my sister, who is a U.S. citizen, but a naturalized U.S. citizen, she's already started talking about leaving the country. My partner's brother is moving to Canada right now. They're U.S. citizens, and they're leaving because of everything that's going on. So that's what's at stake. And that's why we cannot afford to play the games that Democratic Party leadership is playing right now, because even though we have the numbers, that minority of MAGA folks is pretty vicious, and it is beyond obvious that Trump already had no guardrails before, but empowered by the Supreme Court and increasingly senile and increasingly just drunk on his own power and listening to people like Stephen Miller, I don't mean to scare people, but like, I am terrified of the fact that he has access to the nuclear codes. I mean, you know, we saw the video of the Obamas and gorillas. He's posted videos of himself like shitting on protesters. Like, we have crossed the Rubicon, and so we better organize as if our lives depend on it. And we cannot be gaslit by Democratic Party leadership that like a couple of tweaks here and there might get us out of this, because MAGA is a bully movement. You know, they're absolutely about bulldozing. And if you try to accommodate that movement, they're just going to grab more. We've seen it on issue after issue. We're not going to be able to talk around MAGA. We have to defeat these folks. If I'm being fully honest, I feel like until the genocide of Palestinians that we've been forced to watch, I still thought to myself, maybe the Democratic Party has like a kernel of conscience in there. After watching the Democratic Party basically gaslight and move us into ignoring this immense crime against humanity, I remember thinking to myself, okay, well, I understand. Like, we can strategically organize with these folks, but we cannot assume that there's some kind of deep conscience there. There are a lot of things that I'm like afraid of, and there's some tension and I'm not sure about, but this past year I have been like a hawk about the polls, and MAGA is tanking. MAGA is not doing well. And the thing about the internet comments, that's also something that like in this era we all have to be aware of. There are so many bots, so much AI out there, which by the way, MAGA is intentionally using in this fascist campaign. Like, they have been using doctored images. For example, in Minneapolis, there were like these MAGA internet farms that were deploying these fake videos of supposedly Somali immigrants having their, like, you know, Ferraris confiscated in Minneapolis, for example. You know, just complete fake stuff. But because of the sophistication of AI now, it's harder for people to tell. So it's kind of like, you know, for those of you of a certain age, and I want to be clear, I include myself in that. Like, remember the welfare queen in the 80s, that trope that was used to demonize the poor? We have that at a much worse level now because of AI. But all that to go back to the comments thing, like, really, like, you would be surprised, like, the number of times when, even myself, I'm on the internet all the time, you know, someone will say something like really offensive and I'll start to like huff and puff about it. And then I'll go to their actual profile and it is very clear that it's a bot. Like, there's no interaction, there's nothing there. So it creates the perception that there are more of them than there are. But if you look at the poll numbers, it has been very, very clear. They're absolutely tanking. And we can't fall for kind of like this psyop that they're trying to convince us. And they're losing on every level. I mean, I was actually thinking about how the Super Bowl moment was actually kind of exciting, because a year ago, MAGA was starting to make cultural inroads. They were becoming more popular in, like, in comedy, in music, all of that. They have lost all of those inroads. And you could see that yesterday with the Super Bowl, like the people who checked out, you know, obviously the regular halftime program with Bad Bunny, absolutely dwarfed that alternative, you know, Turning Point USA conservative thing that they had. And even in that Turning Point halftime show, artists who had signed up for it started to cancel because they were just like, oh, we don't really want to be associated with this. And a lot of the comedians, podcasters, a lot of the people who used to be strong MAGA people, they're all starting to, you know, do the line of like, well, we didn't vote for this, and starting to move away from all of these fascist actions. There's even lots of articles about like the low morale of ICE officers, which I have to admit, sometimes I read just to feel good about my life. We are winning on certain levels in terms of like numbers and culture. It's just that they have the institutional power, but we don't need to worry about them at this moment. Like, if I were a Republican, I'd be very worried because MAGA is not doing well. So that is something that's very positive that we can work on this year. I mean, it was always going to come to this. I mean, Trump's policies from the beginning were setting up this disaster. And now we're starting to get into the consequences of those policies. To be clear, I do think that there's probably like 20-30% of MAGA or so that, like, they're just going to go down with the ship no matter. I mean, some of them literally, I was thinking about this the other day, some of these MAGA folks are going to be on their deathbed talking about how this Trump era was great, you know. But they are absolutely losing clout, and the sort of momentum is on our side as opposed right now, I think. A lot of the anti-immigrant politics come as a result of corporate globalization and what it's done to this country. You know, these folks who are working class folks should be class allies to undocumented workers, but they have been pit against each other in this, you know, race to the bottom that corporations globally have put out. You know, ever since the big free trade agreements in the 90s that basically killed a lot of the factory jobs that used to be in the southern belt of the US, a lot of folks lost those jobs, right? And those factories, at first, they went down to Mexico, but then they went over to Southeast Asia to keep trying to find cheaper and cheaper workers. And what that ended up doing, that whole free trade agenda, what that ended up doing was basically pitting poor U.S. workers versus poor migrant workers. I often tell people, like, corporations have already unionized at the global level. Like, corporations don't think about borders. They cross borders all the time. It's workers that have been pit against each other. And thankfully, you know, I would say that overall unions have shifted their attitudes towards immigrants. Like, in the 90s, there was a lot more openly sort of, you know, these immigrants are coming to steal our jobs. But there has been a shift where some unions are willing to understand that broader global chessboard, where they realize that, like, oh, no, like, these workers, from other countries who are undocumented are actually our allies, and we need to bring them into the fold, get them to become citizens, and then, you know, get them in the union so that they could raise the wage floor. We could have a better wage floor for all of us. But this is what corporations have been doing for a long time, is pitting poor U.S. workers against undocumented workers. And it's, this is where we're at now. And this is, by the way, this does absolutely fuel a lot of the MAGA rage. Like, whenever they see some awful story of some immigrant who's been here for years, who's getting deported, in their minds, that's like, oh, that's making our economy better. It's not true. It's obviously not true. But it's a con game, and they have bought it, and it's very easy to see. In fact, I actually remember in the late 90s, I was doing some work in sort of upstate New York rural areas with really like poor, poor white families, you know, in living in trailer parks and everything. And I remember working with these folks and thinking to myself, oh my God, like these people have been totally abandoned by the political system. Like Republicans don't give a crap, and Democrats, it's so below their radar. And back then, I remember thinking to myself, like, whew, let's hope some demagogue doesn't like rise up at some point, because he could use that desperation, act as if he cares about these people. And then you add in a dash of racism, you add in a dash of like sexism, xenophobia, you could gain a lot of followers. And so when Trump started to gain traction, I was just like, this was my very easy to read prophecy. This was a lane that the Democratic Party left open. I mean, this is why I'm a leftist, right? Is that I understood even back then that the Democratic Party was not doing enough for the working class. And this is the result of it. I mean, of course, you know, there's the racism, there's the all of those things. But there is definitely an economic aspect to it. And that's actually been one of the biggest sins of the Democratic Party, is they started to lose touch with the working class, to the point that one of the things that made me really angry about 2024 was that they had such terrible policies that MAGA, an openly fascist movement, the Republican Party won the working class, you know, they won working class voters as opposed to Dems. Like, it made me very angry, because to me, the whole point of the Democratic Party is that at the very least, nominally, you're supposed to be there for the working class. But the Dems were so associated with sort of like middle class and upper middle class that the working class looked at the Dems and thought of them as enemies. So that's the dilemma that's been building for many years. So there have been signposts along the way for many, many years that has led to this. You know, as horrendous as this moment is, I mean, we've had a bunch of breadcrumbs to give us a sense of where we were going. And that's why I have so much frustration and anger towards the Democratic Party, because I feel like they missed what was obvious. I think that the Sanders, and I'll be generous, the Sanders-Warren block in 2016, I think that was kind of like our last chance to, at that level, kind of take over politics. But what happened was the Republican Party in 2016, they had a populist uprising, and that was MAGA, and MAGA took over the Republican Party. Sanders and Warren and all the progressives in 2016 tried to have their say in 2016, and the Democratic Party leadership killed that revolution and ended up shooting all of us in the foot. And so we ended up with this imbalance, with a Republican Party that was basically run by MAGA, and a Democratic Party that to this day, as soon as they see a leftist, you know, rear his head, they're just like, okay, we need to destroy this. Like, it blew my mind, the whole like Mamdani election. I was just like, this is the guy who can save the party, and you are devoting all of this energy to try to demonize him. And, you know, that's the party that we're dealing with. And until they understand that we have to be economic populists, and that, yeah, no, of course, Jeff Bezos wasn't going to save us, or those tech folks were not going to save us. They don't care. They just want to make money, you know, and they just put way too much faith in this donor class that largely, I think, has co-opted leadership. I genuinely don't even think that's intentional at this point. I think that some of these folks are just so used to, like, this is how we do politics, that they can't see outside of that little bubble. So we're going to have to overcome them, because I don't think that they're leaving voluntarily. I wanted to say two other things, which is that, one, there's so much of this knowledge out there. Immigrant organizers have been doing this for years. The book that I shared in The Signal called Unbuild Walls, that was written by my friend Silky Shah, who is the head of the Detention Watch Network, is excellent in order to give you a background and framing, especially in terms of abolitionist organizing. But the other thing is, you know, I'm really grateful for you all. Like, genuinely, the other night I was feeling like, you know, oh my God, I'm so tired. All of this stuff is so exhausting. And then I thought of people like you and so many organizers that I know across the country. One of the things that can be debilitating about this era is because of all these bots and AI and really bad media agencies, you know, CBS being co-opted, even aspects of the Washington Post, it can make you feel like you're drowning in this negative stuff. If you look for it, everywhere in this country are like badass organizers pushing back against this. And one of the things that I do know, having been a grassroots organizer for 20 years or so, is that the media is not going to tell you about these folks. You're not going to hear about it. You know, you have to kind of like look for it, because it's not valorized. Even when there are major, major protests, they tend to be sort of undercounted. So I definitely recommend that sometimes, not even necessarily for ideas for organizing, but just so that you can be grounded in this knowledge that we are the majority, to check out across the country, and especially in these cities, right? Minneapolis, LA, Chicago. My God, the amount of organizing happening. Like, I was tearing up the other night because I was just like, these people have not won. They think they've won. If anything, they are starting to weaken. I don't know where this is going to lead. And there's absolutely a scenario in which they win. But I think we absolutely have a solid fighting chance right now. MAGA is wobbly. So now is the time to take advantage of that. So very grateful for you all. Hoping you have a good night. I'm actually going to end my night the way I always do, which is to play guitar, because you got to remember to enjoy this life in the midst of all of this stuff. You know, these MAGA folks want to convince us that life is brutish. I disagree. I love being alive. We're lucky to exist and to have these opportunities, and we can't forget to enjoy ourselves in the midst of the craziness.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was Allie Wayne, abolitionist immigration activist. Allie Wayne, spelled A-L-Y-W-A-N-E, is an undocumented immigrant who has been organizing around immigration issues for over 20 years. An abolitionist immigration activist is someone who believes the current U.S. immigration enforcement system, ICE, Border Patrol, detention centers, deportation courts, and the laws that empower them, is fundamentally harmful and should be dismantled rather than reformed. The term abolitionist signals a radical reimagining of how societies handle migration, moving away from punishment, surveillance, and exclusion, and toward care, mobility, and belonging. Allie Wayne spoke on February 9, 2026 at a webinar sponsored by the Syracuse, New York Peace Council. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.